The mystery of Flight 370 deepens today, Tuesday, March 11th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Conflicting unconfirmed reports and a widening search area confound investigators trying to locate the missing Malaysia Airlines jet.
It's hard to imagine something as large as a 777 going missing. It's a reminder of how big the planet is.
We'll have the latest on the search. And later, meet Lydia, the great white shark being tracked by scientists as she crosses the Atlantic. She's given them a run for their money.
Some days she picks a spot, she seems to like it, she doesn't move much, and other days she can go over 100 miles.
Plus, a photographer finds the perfect place to carry the Lego figure who stars in his pictures.
That tiny pocket on the front right-hand side of a pair of jeans. He fits absolutely perfectly in there, yeah.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-mile run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Crimea is living a multiple-choice reality, it seems. Ukraine still considers the region a part of its territory, but today the Crimean parliament declared Crimea a republic, independent of the rest of Ukraine. And on Sunday, Crimean residents will get to vote in a referendum on whether to join Russia or not. Times' Simon Schuster is in Simferopol, the capital of Crimea. He says the region's pro-Moscow leaders have a clear goal in all of this.
The declaration today was pretty much a repetition of what amounts to a foregone conclusion. They've already voted to split off from Ukraine and to ask for Russia to annex the region. The referendum is essentially getting the people to approve their decision. But again, the leadership here assumes that they will get their way and Crimea will become part of Russia.
So we want to speak with you, Simon, about a man you profiled for Time, the de facto pro-Russian leader of Crimea, Sergei Aksionov. Where does he stand on either independence or joining Russia?
He is a wholehearted supporter of joining Russia, even though he wouldn't mind so much being a semi-independent state as well, as long as it's under Russia's protection, which at this point is pretty much guaranteed. He took power on February 27th after a seizure by armed men of the parliament and the government building, and he has been holding court as the de facto leader ever since.
Aside from a de facto leader, does he have an official title?
The Prime Minister of Crimea.
Right, okay. So a month ago, he was this obscure figure, and now he's Vladimir Putin's go-to guy in the Crimea. Who actually is Sergei Aksionov?
I mean, he has a fascinating biography. His father was actually a separatist pro-Russian leader in the country of Moldova, which in the early 1990s had a very similar situation play out, which resulted in a war. Russia also intervened in that war on the side of the pro-Russian separatists, and it resulted in a breakaway republic declaring independence and splitting off from the Moldovan government. That region is called Transnistria, and it is still an unrecognized quasi-independent state.
You met Aksionov. You interviewed him for this profile. When you met him, what's the first impression you get of Aksionov?
He is a bit of a thuggish guy. He's tall, bulky. He's also the head of the Crimean Greco-Roman Wrestling Federation.
So that,
that tells you something about his physique. He does come off as kind of a guy with street smarts. And indeed, one of the people I interviewed for the profile is sort of a well-known businessman from the 1990s. And the gentleman I spoke to for the profile told me he has known Aksionov for many years, since the 1990s. And he described him as having been a enforcer for the local mafia.
Mm. And Aksionov denies that and says that the gentleman you spoke to is basically full of it.
That's right. Yeah, he says that all those allegations are part of a slander campaign launched by his political opponents.
It does seem to be fairly accurate, though, that Sergei Aksionov, he established himself as an umbrella salesman.
That's right. His father also owned a factory in Moldova, which produced umbrellas. And in his early days, he said he imported umbrellas from Moldova to Crimea, and they would sell them on the bazaars. Sort of typical kind of business in the chaotic days of the 1990s.
Today, Aksionov, I mean, does he control the army in Crimea?
Absolutely, yeah. As soon as the revolution in Ukraine began really gaining momentum last month, Aksyonov immediately began forming a paramilitary force in Crimea. Now, yesterday, he presided over the ceremony in which the first batch of Crimean military troops pledged allegiance to the new separatist government of Crimea. So now, at least in the eyes of Russia, he is also the commander-in-chief of a military force.
Simon Schuster has been speaking with us from Simferopol in Crimea, where he's been covering the crisis there for Time magazine. Simon, thanks, as always.
Thank you.
Now on to a really perplexing story, the Malaysia Airlines jet that seems to have vanished. There's not a lot to go on, but there is a suggestion now that the missing jet might have veered west, way off its scheduled course to Beijing, before disappearing. The Malaysian Air Force's military radar suggests the plane could have changed direction after it lost contact with air traffic controllers. Earlier today, Interpol said it had new information about the two men from Iran who boarded the flight using stolen passports, and it's now inclined to conclude this was not an act of terrorism. But that still doesn't explain what happened to the plane and the 239 people on board. The World's Matthew Bell reports.
The massive international search and rescue effort is now in its fourth day, and it has failed to produce any solid leads as to where that Boeing 777 ended up. So I put the question to David Gallo, director of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Where is the plane?
Isn't that a great question? I mean, this is one of the most perplexing mysteries regarding something lost at sea that I've ever encountered in my career. There's still no evidence at all, not a shred of evidence, that that plane landed in the water.
Gallo's got a lot of experience. He helped find the Air France passenger jet that crashed in 2009. It was flying from Brazil to France and went down over the Atlantic Ocean. 5 days later, some floating debris from the plane and bodies of some of the 228 victims were found. But it still took 2 years for Gallo's team to locate the wreckage and flight data recorders on the ocean floor. There are some similarities with the apparent mid-air disappearance of the Malaysia Airlines jet, but with no clues to go on, Gallo says this case is like trying to solve a murder without a body.
There should be a lot of evidence on the sea surface. The only way to get away from that is if the plane landed wholesale in one piece and then sank suddenly so that there wasn't a lot of pieces.
It's unlikely, Gallo says, but conceivable that the pilot could have landed the plane in one piece somewhere on the water, though in that case you would think the crew would have been able to release emergency chutes, and these would probably be visible to all the search planes, ships, and satellites looking for a crash site.
It is possible, entirely possible, that the search craft missed it. And that's one of the worst things that can happen, is that you go over the spot where it is and think it's not there. In fact, with Air France, when we were doing the bottom search for the plane, we looked at every spot on the ocean more than once, sometimes two and three times, went over the same spot just to be absolutely sure before we left that spot that there was nothing there.
But in the case of the Air France crash, the search team had that initial breakthrough. Right now, Gallo says finding Flight 370 is harder than finding a needle in a haystack. They don't even know what haystack to start looking in. There's the possibility the plane landed somewhere in the Southeast Asian jungle. Science reporter Miles O'Brien is also an experienced pilot. He thinks the Malaysia Airlines jet will eventually be found, but that will mean going back to square one, the moment early Saturday morning, right after the jet lost radio contact.
The plane could still be airworthy and could have flown some great distance without being tracked by radar or any reports coming from the pilots. So that's the difficulty here. You sort of have to think, okay, so where was the last indication of where they were according to controllers? And then how much fuel did they have? And then that you draw a big circle, and that's a huge swath of area. It might take some time.
Science reporter Miles O'Brien ending that report by the World's Matthew Bell. Miles is also the guest for our next interview. It's about the disaster that was just starting to unfold exactly 3 years ago today. On March 11th, 2011, a massive tsunami hit the northeast coast of Japan. Nearly 20,000 people were killed, whole towns were wiped out, and a triple meltdown began at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. The Fukushima story is still very much unfolding, and that's where Miles O'Brien comes in again. He recently traveled to Japan for the PBS NewsHour. So you visited the Fukushima site, Miles, and your report makes it pretty clear that 3 years after the accident, they're still not really even in cleanup mode. So what did you see?
Well, Marco, the issue that really comes to right at the top of the list is the water. Every day, 100,000 gallons of groundwater passes through that plant. Unfortunately, with three exposed nuclear cores, each and every day, 100,000 gallons of water becomes too toxic to allow to get into the sea. So it kind of reminds me of the cartoon Fantasia, The Sorcerer's Apprentice. They're building every other day a 250,000 gallon tank to capture this water. Unfortunately, they're not fully succeeding. And eventually, of course, they're going to run out of space for tanks. And so that raises all kinds of questions about how they're going to clean up this water and make sure it doesn't get dumped into the Pacific.
And that's just the water. What about the core of this plant itself?
Well, reactor number four is where we'll start. That particular facility was under maintenance 3 years ago. So it was not generating electricity, and the process of removing the fuel there is something that TEPCO has managed to figure out an engineering solution. The other three melted reactors are just way too hot to get anywhere near anytime soon by human beings. And so the Japanese are trying to invent robots to go in there and clean that up. But no one has built a robot that can do that kind of work under those kind of circumstances. So we really don't know how they're going to clean it up.
So at the plant itself, not a lot of encouraging news. Now, you also look closely at fish that people eat. First, what's going on locally? Like 3 years later, if you go to Tokyo, will shoppers just avoid buying any fish caught in northeast Japan?
Yeah, there's an area that has just essentially been banned for fishing. There's a whole fleet of fishermen that are out of business. And, you know, for example, we went out on a ship that was gathering flounder, not to sell, but to be tested. Mm. And these fish were actually okay to eat, but the next batch they might catch would be way above the standards. And so really, in essence, for our lifetime and beyond, I suspect there won't be any Fukushima flounder anywhere in Japan or beyond.
Right. And speaking of beyond, let's go farther afield, because scientists have found traces of Fukushima radiation in tuna caught off California. Now, we've reported that concerns are actually unfounded because the levels of radiation are so small. What did you find?
Exactly that. I spoke with Nicholas Fisher at Stony Brook University, and he was the one that 4 months after the meltdown got some bluefin tuna in San Diego. These tuna did, in fact, have measurable amounts of Fukushima cesium in them. However, it was, in fact, safe to eat. Now, you might have some concern if you reached huge amounts, but nowhere near what a normal human being would eat.
Miles, finally, our listeners may know at this point about a freak accident you experienced while on assignment. A box of TV gear fell on your arm, and what seemed to be a bruise at first turned out to be something rare and far worse and led to getting your left arm amputated. Briefly, how have you been coping with the pain and with this sudden shock to your life?
You know, it's interesting, Marco. We think about all the risks we take. I thought this trip, the big risk was going inside the Fukushima power plant, and you just never know. It's been a challenge, to say the least. The thing that has gotten me through is I've been working. My biggest fear was that I wouldn't get these stories about Fukushima on the air, and so I just kind of plowed back in to work as quickly as I could, and that probably helped me get through at least the initial shock of the thing. But in the meantime, phantom limb pain is really excruciating at times. But every day it gets a little bit better, and I am learning how to do most everything. And eventually I'll get a prosthetic arm that will help me fly an airplane and ride a bicycle and, for that matter, shoot video. So, you know, life is a series of challenges. Some you seek and some come to you. And this is one that has come to me, and I'm just doing my best to meet it and overcome it.
Well, we are impressed beyond words, Miles. Thank you so much for the interview and for your persistence to follow the Fukushima story despite the incredible hurdles. Appreciate it.
You're welcome, Marco.
Miles O'Brien is a science correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. The last part of his Fukushima series airs on Thursday night, and we've got a link to his NewsHour interview about losing his arm at PRI.org.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The Gulf Cooperation Council, or GCC, it's a union of countries in the Arabian Gulf region. But the GCC is short on cooperation these days. Three members have withdrawn their ambassadors from another member nation. Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain accuse Qatar of pursuing harmful policies. At issue is Qatar's welcoming attitude toward Islamist groups like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. Saudi Arabia has just branded the Brotherhood a terrorist organization. Omar Chatriwala is a journalist at Doha News in Qatar. He says the view from Doha is that this is a test.
The way one Qatari former diplomat put it, he said that every time there's a government change or a leadership change, then the other countries want to test it to see how powerful that person is or how powerful that leadership is and whether or not they'll go along with their policies or they'll maintain this independence. So
there was a leadership change in Qatar.
Exactly. So there's a leadership change in Qatar in June where the former emir stepped down and handed power to his son, Tamim. And the notion was that when Hamad took power back in 95, then he was faced with the same test as well in terms of his leadership and his ability to hold on to power.
And yet Qatar is in this Gulf Cooperation Council with these other countries. They're supposed to be working together, right? It sounds like Saudi Arabia is kind of just pushing it the way you're describing it, pushing Qatar to see where it stands with this new leadership.
Now, one thing that's interesting to keep in mind is the fact that the ruler of Qatar is 33 years old, whereas the king of Saudi Arabia is in his 80s. So there's a massive generational gap there as well. Not to mention the fact that Saudi Arabia does see itself as a regional powerhouse, as potentially one of the most powerful and with the most resources at its disposal. So to have this little country that is much smaller, has a very young leadership, acting out of line, isn't necessarily going to sit well with everybody.
I'm just curious. I mean, the Gulf Cooperation Council, it's just a handful of countries. Is Qatar alone in this?
Kuwait so far has not really weighed in publicly, and Oman has also not weighed in publicly. What happens behind closed doors, we're not 100% certain. There is going to be an Arab meeting in next month, I believe it is, and there'll be some expectation that Kuwait will step in as something of a mediator within the Gulf Cooperation Council.
So, Omar, this episode, is it worrying to Qataris, or is it just more making people scratch their heads? It's kind of a mystery that nobody gets.
Well, it's a little bit of both. I mean, the fact is that three ambassadors have pulled their people out of the country. So in terms of what an actual crisis for this cooperation council is, they've never been 100% on the same page. There might be some sort of passive-aggressive reactions. And again, a lot of imports, a lot of food imports come from Saudi Arabia into Qatar. So it might be a case whereby trucks are held at the border for a day or so that the freshest food or the freshest produce or maybe isn't coming in, or maybe there'll be a little bit of a scarcity. So, and that might be the case where you're not going to be getting some products that you expect to see regularly from Saudi Arabia. Maybe it'll be decreased, or maybe you're not going to be seeing it as often.
The U.S. must be on the fence about all this. Have you heard what they're saying?
For our part at Doha News, we did contact the U.S. Embassy for comment, and they said we're not terribly concerned about things yet. We're not issuing warnings for Americans to stay clear or anything like that. What the diplomatic front is, obviously, they do have a lot at stake in Qatar, considering the companies that are here, considering the U.S. Airbase that's here. So I'm sure they would be on the side of we don't want things to escalate.
Omar Chatriwala, thank you very much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure.
So every week we have a sideways glance feature, and I've noticed something. It generally involves taking something ordinary and then looking at it in a way that makes the ordinary extraordinary. This week's installment is no exception. It's about drawing big inspiration from a small source. Here's the world's Clark Boyd with a whole new sense of perspective.
I'm going to start this story by giving you an earworm. Sorry, it seems I can't escape this tune these days. My 7-year-old likes to belt it out during her evening shower, which means I wake up singing it to myself. Anyway, Everything is Awesome is, for those of you who have been buried under tiny building blocks for the last few months, the theme song to the Lego Movie. The recently released film imagines a richly detailed life for its animated minifigure characters.
Good morning, apartment. Good morning, doorway. Morning, wall. Morning, ceiling. Good morning, floor. Ready to start the day.
But I'm not going to tell you about that guy, as exciting as he sounds. Instead, I'm going to tell you about a Lego minifig who's not in the Lego Movie. I interviewed him a few days ago.
He's positioned with coffee in hand and poised at the microphone, ready to speak.
Okay, I'll come clean. Again, that's not a Lego minifigure. It's the voice of Andrew White from Portsmouth on England's south coast. And for the past year and a half, White's been carrying around a 1.5-inch plastic Lego man and photographing him every day. It combines two of his lifelong interests, Legos and photography.
I've had cameras for almost as long as I can remember.
But for White, photography was just a hobby until a few years ago. He says he suddenly realized he was tired of the 9-to-5 grind and that he wanted to take a more active role in caring for his young kids. So White chucked it all in and became a freelance photographer. He worked mostly at night after the kids were asleep. But he also wanted to find a way to take more pictures during the day. And then, on a trip to the Lego store with his kids in August of 2012...
My children pointed out that there was a camera accessory that fits into a Lego minifigure's hand. And I built a minifigure around that camera and just started to position that minifigure with camera into the everyday snaps that I were taking with my mobile phone.
At first, White just posted the shots to his Facebook page. He got a good response. And so, in October of 2012, White and his miniature helper committed to a larger project.
He went everywhere I went for a whole year.
So, does he go in your pocket?
That's right. I finally found a use for that tiny pocket on the front right-hand side of a pair of jeans.
He fits perfectly in there, right?
He fits absolutely perfectly in there, yeah.
White calls it legography. And he's still doing it. A shot a day, rain or shine. And yes, White gets some strange looks from passers-by.
I spend quite a lot of time down at real ground level because the figure usually is positioned on terra firma, down on the ground, and the camera is held upside down so the lens is as close to the ground as possible. And that's what helps to introduce this kind of forced perspective, this sense of scale that makes the figure look much closer to life-size than he actually is.
In one of my favorite shots, White has his minifig slipping on a life-sized banana peel. His little Lego camera looks like it's flying out of his hand.
The Lego camera was being dropped into the shot from just out of view of my iPhone. It took 19 attempts to get the positioning right.
In another picture, the minifigure, camera in hand, flees from a crab on the beach. It puts me in mind of this great little behind-the-scenes online featurette for the Lego movie, where one of the characters talks about being manhandled by the directors.
They would just pick us up and physically move us across a set. It's not cool. I'm like, I'm a prop or something.
By the way, Andrew White didn't give his minifig a name. White decided it was better to maintain a bit of distance from his subject. I asked him if the Lego company was at all upset at him using one of their products for his project. He told me he hasn't heard a peep from Lego. White does say, though, that while his project was in no way meant to coincide with the Lego movie, the film's release has helped get legography some attention. He's more than doubled his followers on social media in recent weeks. Oh, and as an apology for the earworm, I put together a slideshow of White's legography shots. You can see them at PRI.org. And yes, they are awesome. For The World, I'm Clark Boyd. Everything is awesome. Everything is cool when you're part
of the team. Everything is awesome. News headlines just ahead on PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, the young men and women who hold our cybersecurity in their hands. And later, how teaching girls in rural India to grow and sell vegetables can change their lives.
They make just enough money that they might be able to pay their school fees, and often their fathers feel like they can risk delaying their marriage a bit. You know, that's everything.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-mile run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. As a kid, I learned how to replace the needle on a record player and how to take apart a cassette to untangle the audio tape. That's the sort of technology I grew up with. The young Israeli you're about to meet grew up mastering technology of a whole different nature. He's a whiz at hacking and at protecting systems from hacking. Reporter Daniel Estrin met up with him as part of our series on the millennial generation and their feelings about security.
Remember the good old days when all you had to fear was nuclear annihilation by the Soviet Union? Today's threats may be even more scary because you'll be alive as they happen. Your electricity getting cut off, your bank account being emptied, your airplane getting hijacked. All of it at the click of a mouse.
I believe that cybersecurity represents a threat honestly, most, even more than most of the threats that you can think of.
Israeli cyber expert Nir Geist is 25 years old, but he's been exploring the ins and outs of cybersecurity for more than half his life. When he was only 10 years old, Israel's largest banks hired him to hack into their systems to learn how to prevent hackers.
Actually, there was no large bank in Israel where I didn't transfer actual money between bank accounts.
By the time he was 14 years old, he took a few phone calls from Bill Gates. They discussed cybersecurity, which Geist calls the world's biggest threat. It's a brave new world of technology, but often there's still a human touch. Take cyber bank robbery. Hackers will send a banker an email that looks like it's from the boss. It'll include a link to a website that looks exactly like the bank's homepage, but actually, it lets him in the door.
If this employee is even a simple cashier in the bank, this employee has some access to many accounts, to many customers, to an actual money in the bank. So it gives me a lot of access to hack inside the bank.
It's not news that computer hackers are stealing stuff through the internet, but Geist predicts that the future will bring more cyber attacks on things that you might not even think were connected to the internet. He says computer experts like him can go just about anywhere, even into critical infrastructure connected to isolated sensitive networks that are supposedly disconnected from the World Wide Web.
We can control the traffic. We can control the nuclear facilities. I can tell you for sure that we can control water. We can control food. We can control almost everything by using cyber infrastructure.
Geist sat down in front of two laptops and showed me how easy it can be.
So it will take me just less than 1 minute.
Geist races his fingers over one of the keyboards at warp speed, as if he were born doing this stuff. He writes a malicious code, an endless stream of numbers and letters, like a scene from The Matrix. Then he sends it to a second laptop, protected with a popular antivirus software. The software pops up and says it's caught the virus. So Geist makes a simple cosmetic change to the code. However, there's a 9 in the code, he substitutes 6+3. That's it. Then he sends the virus to the protected laptop again, and the virus infects it.
So as you can see, the firewall didn't mention anything during this attack.
It didn't detect the hack at all. Here it says your computer is protected.
Antivirus programs work by protecting your computer from a list of known threats. Every time a new virus is unleashed on the world, antivirus companies have to scramble to add those threats to the list. Geist's company, Neutron, is developing software that does the opposite. It monitors your computer's normal activity to find any actions that are out of the ordinary. So the idea is to detect viruses that may not even exist yet. The failure to prevent 9/11 has been attributed to a failure of imagination, intelligence services not being able to predict something of that scale ever happening. Geist says to predict cyber threats, you need the imagination of a kid and the intimate knowledge of cyberspace that only a kid has.
The older generation did not grow up with a computer in his room. I did. I have a computer from the age of 4 or 5. I start developed in the age of 6. I didn't know what it means and how effective it can be.
Kids are known to mess around without really understanding the consequences of their actions. In cyberspace, this can get serious. Our finances, our governments, our energy resources, our lives are dependent on the digital. And cyber genius kids are very easily able to hack into these systems.
The 6-year-old boy of today, he already knows what is hacking. He already knows how precious is this knowledge and how powerful it is. I think that there are very young kids today who can cause a damage, not like a nation, but not very far from it. So they want the world to know about their talent. They enjoy the glory and the fame.
Geist's message, governments have a lot to learn from their cyber-savvy youth. In other words, it takes a kid to catch a kid. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin, Herzliya.
Afghanistan today laid to rest one of its top leaders. Vice President Mohammad Qasim Fahim was buried in Kabul. Officials said he died of natural causes on Sunday at the age of 57. Fahim was a former military commander who helped the U.S. oust the Taliban after 9/11. Mariam Aman is with the BBC Persian service in Kabul. So the head of a think tank in Kabul called the late Vice President Fahim one of three key powers in Afghanistan in recent years, along with President Hamid Karzai and the Americans. Is that too much to say? I mean, who was Qasim Fahim?
Well, I don't disagree with that saying. And it seems that Marshal Qasim Fahim has been in power for almost 13 years. But before that, he was part of the resistance forces under Commander Massoud, who was killed by Al-Qaeda, allegedly Al-Qaeda members, who killed him on the 9th of September. After the 9th of September,
9th of September 2001. That's Ahmed Shah Massoud you're referring to.
Indeed. When he died, Commander Qasim Fahim got the power and he became the key player in the whole political system that we are witnessing, from jirgas to the conferences to the political appointments to the relations with West or in the region, anything you name it. And he played a key role in everything.
I mean, being the successor to Ahmed Shah Massoud, he was a lightning rod. So was Qasim Fahim also controversial? Does he have blood on his hands?
From early 90s till Taliban took over most parts of Afghanistan, he was a key player in that government, which was led by President Burhanuddin Rabbani, which was killed 2-3 years ago. Mm. He played a key role and he was the head of the national security. But whether he had a direct hand in blood or whether he killed people, that hasn't been proven, and there has been always allegations.
There was a funeral for Qasim Fahim today on a hilltop in Kabul. I don't know if you managed to see any of that and kind of how he was remembered today.
So today's funeral was a mark of his power, and thousands of people have poured in into Kabul's hilltop. And his body was taken over there, and there were thousands of people paying their last respect to Fahim, everyone calling God is great, and Fahim, we will remember you and we will follow your path. It was an emotional outpour of people who came to Kabul, despite the fact that it's winter and today we had snow last night. But that did not deter his fans to come over from different parts of Afghanistan.
Now, his death comes 1 month before elections to choose a successor to President Karzai, who is barred from seeking a third term. Does Fahim's death change any of the dynamics in the election?
Well, it has been said that Fahim inherited a military side in Afghanistan, which was left by Ahmad Shah Massoud. Although Afghanistan has its national army and police, but there are some traditional way of loyalties that is still in place, and Fahim enjoyed all of those. He still had a lot of influence over those forces. He kind of played a mediator role, both the government and for those forces who were now political opposition, not armed opposition, who once were part of resistance forces against Taliban. So right now, his absence in the government leaves a huge vacuum. And we are only, say, 3 weeks to the elections. There is a speculation that the absence of Marshal Fahim in that post will probably cause a lot of problem if the level of fraud is extensive and people contest this election, then there is no such force who kind of would lobby between the sides and would bring a peaceful result to the election. So there are forces now thinking that we should replace him by somebody who might be able to kind of tame the situation and manage it and bring a peaceful result to the election. Well, the election is the main concern after his demise.
Mariam Aman with the BBC Persian service in Kabul. Thanks very much for talking to us about Qasim Fahim.
My pleasure.
Closer to home now, there's been a doubling this year of the number of people apprehended at the U.S. border who say they fear returning to their country. And about two-thirds of those who made so-called credible fear claims were from El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. Jill Replogle of San Diego station KPBS went to Guatemala to find out why people have been fleeing north.
It's a cool, sunny morning in Guatemala City. A vendor hawks the country's most popular newspapers, Prensa Libre and Nuestro Diario. The newspapers are often filled with stories about brutal gang and drug-related violence. It's the same in Honduras and El Salvador. Just down the street from the newspaper vendor is the Casa del Migrante. It's a shelter for migrants headed north to the U.S. or for people who've just returned because they were deported. Here I meet Maria. She's 63, petite, and from Honduras. In January, she fled her home there along with 12 relatives. The coastal city in Honduras where they lived, San Pedro Sula, is known for gang violence. She shows me a newspaper clipping about the murder of a young man in a wheelchair.
Me mataron a mi hijo el 27 de febrero del 2011.
The man was her son, shot dead 3 years ago by suspected gang members.
Me balearon otro. Un menor me lo tienen sentenciado, el menor que tengo.
Gang members shot another of my sons, she says. They threatened to kill my youngest. And because of all this, I had to flee my country, she says.
If you're living in an area that's affected by gangs and other organized crime groups, unfortunately, you find yourself trapped in a situation of real civic helplessness.
Thomas Borman is an expert on Central American criminal groups.
You are exposed to criminal groups that engage in what are truly incomprehensible levels of violence and barbarism.
Ian Borman says people generally can't turn to local authorities. They can lack the resources to help, or they might face threats from criminals. Or, like in Maria's case, she feared the police colluded with the gangs. She tried the National Human Rights Office, and they suggested she and her family leave the country. So they went to Guatemala. But they don't feel safe here either. Central American gangs know no borders.
Me gustaría, pues, Estados Unidos o Canadá.
Maria says she'd like to go to the U.S. or Canada, and her main way out is in a folder that she tightly clutches. It's thick with family documents and evidence, like the newspaper clipping. She hopes it will win them asylum. Currently, the number of Central Americans like Maria seeking asylum in the U.S. is still small compared to those simply migrating to be with family or find work. But the situation is changing. The number of people at the U.S. border saying they fear going back to their home country is growing at a huge rate. Borman says these trends put immigration authorities in a tricky spot.
There seems to be a concern on the part of the U.S. government, and it is in no way an illegitimate concern, that if the government begins to grant asylum and other forms of immigration relief to people claiming persecution from gangs, other organized crime groups, corrupt police officers, etc., that there will be essentially a floodgate effect.
Back at the Casa del Migrante in Guatemala, two young men from Honduras play dominoes in the patio. I ask one of the players, José Antonio Urbina, why he's trying to get to the U.S. I'm looking for a better life, he says, and mostly because my family is in the U.S., my mom, my son. Urbina says he was deported last year after living in L.A. since 1998. But some legislators think people like Urbina might lie about their motives if caught at the border. Congressman Bob Goodlatte of Virginia thinks that fraud could explain the sharp rise in Central American asylum seekers.
Because of our well-justified reputation for compassion, many people are tempted to file fraudulent claims just so they can get a free pass into the United States.
Goodlatte also chairs the House Judiciary Committee and recently held hearings on asylum fraud. Despite his concerns, most of the lawyers, academics, and asylum experts I spoke with doubted that many Central American migrants were gaming the system, and they warned that making it easier to deport people who fear returning to their home country could have tragic results if their claims were true. Back in Guatemala, Maria and her family are busy gathering more documentation to make their asylum claim.
Lamentablemente, en nuestro país no podemos vivir ya.
God knows we're not lying, she says. We can't live in our country anymore, she says. For The World, I'm Jill Replogle, Guatemala.
PRI.org is our online home when we're not on the radio, but there are other ways to find The World, like Flipboard. This app takes our radio show and turns it into a magazine. Our stories turn into pages that you can flip through, but you can play them and hear all the voices you know from the world. It's a wonderful thing, and it runs on your iPad, iPhone, or Android device. Find it at flip.it/PRI. Again, that's flip.it/PRI. This is The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Lydia, It's a pretty name for a pretty majestic creature. Lydia is a 2,000-pound, 14-foot-long great white shark, and she has a pretty adventurous spirit. Lydia is being monitored by scientists as she crosses the Atlantic Ocean. She's more than halfway across and heading for Ireland. She was tagged a year ago off the coast of Florida by a team of scientists, including Greg Scommel. He's a senior scientist with the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries. So, Greg Scommel, tell us what's so special about Lydia.
Well, Lydia is one of those sharks that we tagged that seems to be exhibiting quite dramatic movement. Right now, she's closer to Ireland than she is to us, and she's making the very first documented transatlantic migration of a white shark. So it's pretty fascinating to watch.
Right. So first documented doesn't mean it hasn't happened before, but it's the first time that it's actually been seen and been monitored, and you've got the data on it.
Exactly. Yeah, it doesn't mean they haven't been doing this for eons. It's just now, for the very first time, we have one to spy on.
Can you break it down in terms of miles per hour? Like, how's she averaging?
You know, some days she picks a spot, she seems to like it, and she doesn't move much. And other days she can go over 100 miles.
Now, we've got this incredible video at our website, PRI.org, of Lydia being tagged last year. Explain to us what goes into tagging a great white shark.
The O-Search team that we were working with, these guys were able to locate and capture a big white shark that we then brought out of the water on their massive lift system, which is a remarkably humbling experience to see one of these massive animals right in front of you, which gives us amazing access to these creatures so that we can tag them. So what we're trying to do is place multiple kinds of tags on the shark while we get additional tissue samples, and those tissue samples could include a piece of skin, a muscle plug. We take blood from the animal, and we can learn a lot about the creature itself from those tissue samples.
Any close calls where the sedation wears off?
We don't want to sedate them because it could kill them. All we do is we irrigate the shark's gills, meaning that we give the shark the sensation that it's breathing. It can respire. It's not holding its breath. And we cover its eyes, and we try to achieve all this in about 15 minutes, and remarkably, the shark remains very still.
That's incredible. So tell us what you've learned about great whites since you've tagged this group.
Well, in the beginning, when we started tagging white sharks, we thought that the migration along the eastern seaboard of the United States was fairly simple. The more sharks we tagged, we started seeing, you know, dynamic movements that were much broader in scale than we ever imagined. And a good example of that is Mary Lee's movements and, of course, now Lydia's movements.
Mary Lee is another shark?
Yeah, Mary Lee is another shark we tagged. We tagged her in September on Cape Cod 2012, and she exhibited some broader spatial patterns that went out into the offshore areas, the deep water areas of the Atlantic. But nothing has matched what Lydia's doing as she continues to just move east and north.
Greg, I think of Lydia, I think of Mary Lee. These are really beautiful names. Great white sharks, not such a pleasant creature. How did they get these names?
Well, you know, the research is sponsored by corporations, including Caterpillar, and Caterpillar actually chose Lydia, and Mary Lee is actually Chris Fisher, who's the founder of O-Search. It's his mom. So, you know, they're beautiful names for beautiful animals, and in giving them these nice names, we're also trying to change the image of the white shark. All too often, we think of it as a horrible creature that wants to consume people, and it really isn't. It's a charismatic creature that we should revere.
Greg Scommel, senior scientist with the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries. Thanks for telling us about Lydia.
My pleasure, Marco. Thank you.
Want to see where Lydia goes next? We put a link to the O-Search Global Shark Tracker at PRI.org. It is a cool map. Finally today, a story about gardening. Monica Barman is a teenager in rural India who grows vegetables in a tiny rooftop garden. She's part of a program to empower women in villages across West Bengal. She's also the subject of Megan Mylan's new film, After My Garden Grows. I asked Mylan to describe Monica's hometown.
It's a very, you know, picturesque small village, like, you know, pull up your village flashcard and it's there. But it's a really lovely place if you have a ticket out. The families living there are dealing with sort of the whole ball of wax of poverty and landlessness, poor nutrition, and particularly for girls, sort of the added issues of access to education and child marriage. So there's a lot going on as these families sort of struggle to survive.
Right, a lot of struggles. And I was actually surprised to see how openly frustrated and even angry these young women are about some of the conditions of life they face.
The girls that you see in the film are becoming quite aware that the legal age of marriage is 18, that they have a right to stay in school, that they have the right to inherit land. And particularly Monica, our main character, is just such a present, feisty 16-year-old. And I feel like when you see her parents really actively, you know, searching for a husband to marry her, you just have this, I hope, you know, what I had was this gut reaction of a future just closing down.
Mm. Map it out for us, Megan. Getting girls to grow food, to farm, how does that keep them from getting married off at an early age? Connect the dots for us.
You know, it's not an obvious thing. Why would taking a gourd to market change your future? You know, these challenges are really economic. They're tradition and economic all, you know, rolled in together. What can happen with just the bit of sale that happens when these girls grow gourds or pumpkins or whatever they might sell at market is they make just enough money that they might be able to pay their school fees. And often their fathers feel like they can risk delaying their marriage a bit. And, you know, that's everything.
And there is that amazing scene in the market where Monica goes to sell that one gourd she gets off a rooftop garden. And she's holding those 20 rupees in her hand like it's gold. What was it like, though, for her to be, it seemed, the only woman selling goods in such a place?
Exactly. I mean, it's just not tradition. You know, business is men's work. And she goes with her father. And, you know, when you spend time with her inside sort of the compound, their houses are sort of a series of three little buildings. And she's surrounded by all the other women. She seems so strong and bold. And she's wasn't, you know, a shrinking violet at the market, but it was clear she was, you know, odd woman out.
What do you think Monica's future is going to be like?
On the first level, her life already has changed. I mean, she is already aware that she should have different options. But I really genuinely believe that the time is really ripe. The conversations happening internationally and in India, focusing on what an amazing impact you can make with even a small investment in the future of a girl.
Who knew so much depends on a gourd? Megan Mylan, Academy Award-winning director of the new film After My Garden Grows. Thanks for speaking with us, Megan.
Thanks so much, Marco.
Full disclosure, my colleague here at The World, Sonia Narang, was in charge of sound for the film. And we leave you with just a small sample of the music in the documentary. It features Prasanna, a guitarist and major figure in South Indian classical or Carnatic music. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being with us.
Is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, online at ritaallen.org. By the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet, and by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.